Case number 21-3787, State of Ohio versus Janet Yellen et al. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Winnick for the appellants.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Mr. Winnick, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Daniel Winnick for the federal government. Ohio's facial challenge to the offset provision rests on the incorrect premise that the provision prevents states from cutting taxes. By its plain terms, it does not. The provision prevents states only from using federal fiscal recovery funds to pay for a reduction in their net tax revenue caused by tax cuts. States are free to pay for tax cuts using their own money, whether through increased revenue from economic growth or through increases in other taxes, or through spending cuts outside an area where they're spending fiscal recovery funds. But the merits aren't properly before the court in the posture of this case, because Ohio has failed to answer a basic question. What is it that it wants to do that it can't do because of this provision? No court of which we're aware has held a funding condition to be facially unconstitutional on ambiguity grounds. Rather,
let me just ask you this question. You mentioned something that would require getting to the merits, but can we decide the existence or non-existence of an injury in fact without reaching the merits in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. So the merits issues in this case are the ambiguity and the coercion claims that Ohio has brought. And those claims are premised on an understanding of the statute, the understanding that the statute prevents states from cutting taxes, or at least can be read to prevent states from cutting taxes. And the point about the lack of a concrete dispute here is that the statute simply doesn't say that. What the statute says is a state can't use fiscal recovery funds to pay for a tax cut. And our point about the lack of a concrete controversy is that Ohio simply hasn't established any genuine controversy about the meaning of the statute as it is, as opposed to this imagined version of the statute. Ohio hasn't established what it is that it wants to do that it can't do because of this statute. So, for example, it points to the fact that its legislature, you know, cut taxes to the tune of some $2 billion. That doesn't establish jurisdiction. That establishes why there's not jurisdiction. It hasn't been prevented from cutting taxes. It has, in fact, cut taxes. And it hasn't tried to show in any serious way that it is at risk of recoupment of any of its fiscal recovery funds because of that tax cut that its legislature enacted. It didn't try to allege, let alone show, that it's going to have a net reduction in its net tax revenue. It hasn't said anything about how it plans to pay for that tax cut or why it would implicate the offset provision. And so really what Ohio is doing is asking the court to hold, and it successfully persuaded the district court to hold, that this provision can never be enforced against Ohio in any set of circumstances, even against conduct that would plainly violate the provision, on the basis of the fact that, you know, Ohio claims there could be uncertainty about the about how the provision applies in hypothetical circumstances not presented here.
Counsel, let me ask you how. Apparently, there have been some tax cuts since the funds were taken. How is the federal government, the agency, going to address those? I mean, what's the procedure through which you're going to determine that the state, whether the state has complied with the condition or not, with respect to those tax cuts that have already occurred?
Sure. So the Treasury Department has explained in regulations that at the end of each, you know, reporting period, a state is going to have to report if it has made changes to its tax laws. It's going to have to report whether it projected that those tax changes would reduce its net tax revenue. And if it did make that, if it did have that expectation, it has to explain, you know, what sources of state funding are available to pay for the reduction in its net tax revenue. Now, Ohio didn't.
Yeah, then, and this determination was after you've already seen what the tax revenue was for the year. And then you can make an assessment of whether tax revenue actually went down because of the tax cuts or not.
So one way in which a state could show that it has complied with the provision is to show, yes, on the basis of actual tax revenue, that it hasn't suffered any reduction in its tax revenue relative to the baseline. And here, there's every reason to believe, on the basis of Ohio's public records, and Ohio notably hasn't disputed, that its tax revenue has increased from the pre-pandemic baseline, and that it's likely to have no reduction in its net tax revenue even after these tax cuts. That's why, you know, it is a genuine genuine problem that Ohio hasn't tried to show why these tax cuts are going to implicate the provision, because there's every reason to think they may not. And
so let's suppose at that point, say a year from now, there is a finding. Let's say the tax revenue does go down at that point. So what else can the state do anything else to protect itself from losing the ARP funds at that point?
Sure. So there are three ways in which a state can permissibly offset a negative revenue effect from a tax cut. It can do it if, thanks to economic growth, it has increased tax revenue. It can do it by increasing other taxes, or it can do it by cutting spending outside the areas where it's spending fiscal recovery funds. And, you know,
suppose that a year from now, the state can't meet any of those requirements as Treasury interprets the reg. Would you agree then the case would be ripe for adjudication of any constitutional challenge?
Yes, Your Honor. In that circumstance, there would be a recoupment proceeding. Ohio could raise as a defense to the recoupment proceeding the ambiguity arguments it's now making. And it's worth noting, just in terms of kind of the ways in which a state can permissibly offset the revenue effects of a tax reduction, these are not new analyses for a state to make. Any state that has a balanced budget requirement, including Ohio and virtually every other state, is entirely familiar that when it cuts taxes, it has to determine whether that tax change is going to reduce its net tax revenue. And if it's going to, then in order to balance the state's budget, it has to pay for those tax cuts, either by saying that because of economic growth, its tax revenue hasn't been reduced, or by cutting spending, or by increasing other taxes. So really the only thing this provision is doing is saying that when a state makes that determination, it can't use this new pot of federal funds to balance its books. If it's going to cut taxes, it has to be able to pay for that tax cut with other funds, with its own money. So there's no genuine ambiguity about this provision, and there certainly isn't a basis to do what the district court did, which is hold the provision facially unconstitutional and enjoin its enforcement in any circumstances on the basis of, you know, speculation about uncertainty that could arise in other circumstances down the line.
What it seems like, you know, as far as the ambiguity argument goes, there's a dispute over whether or not this regulation can really clarify an ambiguity in the statute itself. Do you have any authority for that proposition, that a federal agency can, through regulation, clarify an ambiguity that is in the enabling statute itself?
So I can answer that question, Your Honor, but let me first explain why that issue is really not presented here. We are not arguing that the validity of this statute turns in any way on the extent to which Treasury has provided additional details by the regulation. This statute, you know, this is a challenge to the statute, not the regulation. The statute is valid on its own, and so the regulations just are not relevant here, which is why the district court was wrong to opine on the irrelevant question whether the regulations were statutorily authorized. So the court needn't and shouldn't address that question. It just to answer the question, courts, including this court, routinely defer to regulations that implement conditions on the use of federal funds in the Medicaid context, in the context of welfare programs, in the context of education funding. And they do that because Congress has recognized that in the spending clause context, just as in every other context, a statute does not itself have to resolve every detail of how it is going to be applied. Agencies can and do explain by regulation how they're going to go about operationalizing a statute, and courts routinely defer to those regulations. So again, we're not invoking deference here. The regulations are not relevant here. This is a challenge to the statute.
Hey, Counselor, before we get to the merits of the statute, whether it's unconstitutionally ambiguous or unconstitutionally vague, we have to decide the standing issue, which is the threshold issue. Could you just summarize your lack of standing arguments to us?
Yes, Your Honor. The point is that Ohio simply hasn't identified what it wants to do that this statute prevents it from doing. There's no concrete dispute as to the application of the offset provision. You know, as we've explained, whenever states have challenged conditions on the use of federal funds as ambiguous, those disputes have arisen in the course of, you know, concrete disagreements where the government thinks that a condition forbids a state from doing something and the state thinks otherwise, and courts have been able to resolve the meaning of the statute.
They say their first defense is that they say the offer was ambiguous, but here there's already been an acceptance of the offer. So is that defense, is that argument moot now?
I certainly framed in those terms, it's moot, Your Honor. I mean, I think they try to continue pressing the point that they're standing simply because they were entitled to clarity in some abstract sense. But as the district court in Arizona recognized, you know, at that level of generality, that's a purely abstract injury. In order to have standing, to have to establish jurisdiction to challenge a condition on the use of federal funds, just as any other statute, a state has to show some concrete way in which it's burdened by the condition. And that's what Ohio hasn't been able to do. They haven't pointed to any way in which they're being concretely harmed by this condition.
Okay. Was there a deadline by which the funds had to be accepted by the state?
No, Your Honor. The statute prescribes a sort of time frame for Treasury to pay out the funds, but there was not a deadline by which the state funds had to be accepted. I believe every state has now accepted the funds, and certainly Ohio did.
Did Ohio accept all the funds? I thought I read something that they've accepted two point some billion, but they were given 5 billion or something.
So, Your Honor, the funds are paid out in multiple tranches. So I believe they've accepted the entirety of the first tranche of funds.
Okay, they've accepted it, but perhaps they haven't received it all yet.
Yes, I think what they've done is accept the first tranche and receive the first tranche of funds, and the second tranche, I think, is due to be paid out in a few months.
Okay. All right. Any further questions, Judge Donald?
No.
Judge Bush?
No.
All right. You'll have your 3 minutes rebuttal. All right. Let's hear from the Solicitor General, Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Judge Griffin, and may it please the court. I'll plan to get to the merits in a moment. This is unconstitutional for two separate reasons, but I do briefly want to begin by addressing your argument, your question regarding standing. We have standing for five separate reasons, any one of which would be independently sufficient to justify to create an Article III controversy. I'll actually start with maybe the easiest one, which is because of the tax mandate, the state has to divert and spend resources tracking compliance with the tax mandate. So if you look
is that in your complaint, the compliance cost? I didn't think it was.
We did not allege, I don't think it specifically says compliance cost, but it says it would interfere with the fiscal, with our orderly management of our fiscal funds, which suffices at the complaint stage. And then here at this stage, 42 USC 802 D2 says that we have to have a detailed accounting of the use, the quote use of ARPA funds. And the tax mandate defines indirect offsets to be a use of ARPA funds. So because of the tax mandate, that is now a use that we have to spend resources tracking, interfering with our orderly budget management. We have the sovereign injury.
But counsel, is the state required to accept the funds? And if the state agrees to accept them, I mean, there are conditions that that are a part of the process. And when the state makes the decision that it wants to accept, they balance those things. And so how can that be an injury?
It's always an online injury, it's always a injury in fact when a court has to spend money based on another party's allegedly illegal conduct. We allege illegal conduct here in the terms of the conditions. And if the fact that we could accept or deny defeated standing, there would never be a spending clause challenge. That's true of every spending clause law. The state can accept the conditions or not.
Is it true, though, you have to accept the funds in order to bring a spending clause challenge?
We do not think you have to accept the funds to bring a spending clause challenge.
The concern I have with your first theory is that this compliance cost arises from the fact that you accepted the funds, not from the fact that that there was a requirement to begin with.
And so that injury was actual or imminent from the outset of the case, because we alleged that not only would we accept the funds, but we were coerced into accepting the funds. And that goes to the first injury, which is deprivation.
You're coerced to accept money from the federal government? I don't quite understand that argument at all.
Well, that would go to the merits of whether the coercion argument succeeds. But yes, you can allege that you were coerced into agreeing to conditions on sovereign authority and that that's unconstitutional. That's what grounded the state's standing in NFIB for the coercion argument there. So deprivation of a legal entitlement is grounds for standing. And here we've alleged both that we were denied unambiguous terms, both at the offer stage and now going forward, we lack the terms if the injunction were to be vacated. So that's an injury. We have the sovereign injury, and in that this will preempt state laws. It will force us to pay recoupment in the event that one of our laws violates its provision, the meaning of which we cannot identify.
In the event that it's found down the road, or there's an allegation. I mean, you know, that's speculative. That's conjecture. That doesn't really sound like a concrete injury. It sounds like a hypothetical injury that may not occur. We as federal courts, as opposed to the state courts, we're limited in our jurisdiction to actual cases and controversies. And we normally don't render declaratory judgments as to hypotheticals. And my problem with this is that it really does appear to be hypothetical, that what if the federal government did this? What if the federal government took this stand? The federal government says, we're not doing that. Well, what if they change their mind? I mean, is this a matter that really that we've got jurisdiction on? And I just question it.
So, Your Honor, that's the theory that the Supreme Court reversed this court and Susan B. Anthony for adopting. In that case, the advocacy agency said, we plan to engage an act in some future election, no specified election, no specified date, that because of this unconstitutional law may be enforced against us. The reason we can't say with certainty whether the government will enforce it against us or not is because the as Judge Cole explained below, the tax mandate is so lacking in semantic content that we cannot tell what it forbids or requires. And just with any vague law, you could always make the argument that you can engage in the argument or not. And in the event you engage in the argument and you're charged with a crime, you can sue for an injunction that will redress your injury. But of course, no court requires that in the vagueness context, and there's no reason it would be required here.
So, Kessler, how would Ohio be harmed by waiting for a possible recoupment action? Right now, you don't know whether the government is going to seek recoupment or not. So why would the court be required to deal with this now when there is no tangible evidence that the government is going to seek recoupment? There's no tangible evidence now. And if there were an action, it would certainly be ripe for court action at that time. So why is there an injury at this point when there's been no evidence that the government intends to proceed with the recoupment action?
The reason we're injured is because we do not know if this applies to us, what we're prohibited or not prohibited from doing with respect to the tax mandate. And should they bring an action later, we'll face something of a double penalty, because not only will we have lost tax revenue, we'll be forced to pay back an equal amount to Treasury, which is potentially billions of dollars. So the state has to labor under this cloud of ambiguity, much like a citizen faced with a vague law has to act without any notice of what they can or can't do. And courts have never said that you have to wait until they somehow specify what they're going to charge you with before you can bring an injunction to challenge a vague law. The Kenny case we cite from the Fourth Circuit makes that clear, that the reason the individual there could not state with specificity what they wanted to do that was prohibited was precisely because the law is vague. And that's true here. I can go to ambiguity because I think it's tied up with.
Okay, but before you go to ambiguity, let me just ask, if this injunction stands, would the government be put in a posture then of being unable to seek recoupment, even if Ohio decided that they were going to use the rescue money to offset the tax cut? If this injunction stood,
They would not be able to enforce the tax mandate. We do not challenge and would still remain in place 802C1, which specifies impermissible uses. So if we spent the money on something other than a permissible use, they would be free to seek recoupment for that.
Okay.
On ambiguity, the problem is after three rounds of briefing and two oral arguments, we still have no idea what the secretary thinks the statute means. There's the indirectly offset point, which is completely vacuous because given the fungibility of money, every dollar of ARPA funds can accurately be described as indirectly offsetting every loss of revenue. But the statute, as opposed to the regulations, the statute provides absolutely no guidance regarding which are permissible and which are not. Then we have reduction in net tax revenue. The problem there is there's no baseline to compare it against. So what does it mean? Well, the secretary insists that, in fact, this is all quite clear, but they can't again, give you any definition of what those terms mean. They will not be able to stand up in rebuttal. And aside from the regulation, define those terms in a way they've ever defined them before that would give the states any clarity. That's the injury, is we have to make our taxing policy without having any idea whether we're violating this provision, which could subject us to
counsel. I understand your frustration, the idea that there would be frustration from interpreting these provisions. I guess what I'm struggling with is, first of all, the ripeness issue, whether or not this has really been, you really have a controversy and imminent harm to the state. I'm also concerned by the fact that the state accepted the funds after you had made this allegation that it was too difficult for the state to understand the condition. And then the state proceeded not only to accept the funds, but to cut taxes, which indicates to me it kind of undercuts your whole allegation that you're being chilled in the taxing power by ambiguous provisions in the statute.
So let me
address that.
Sure. Let me take it in a few steps. The standing inquiry is focused strictly on the moment we filed the complaint. Anything later would go to mootness. On standing, at the moment we filed the complaint, we were imminently harmed because we were deprived the clear terms to which we're entitled. We did allege that we had to take the funds, and we were in fact had no realistic option, which is the coercion analysis. So
that's based on economic conditions that
tell me why you have no option of turning down the $7 billion. I mean, this Ohio has balanced budget already. Why are you coerced to take money from the federal government?
Sure. I want to first define what coercion means, and then I can explain that. So if you look at NFIB, the question is whether the state had any realistic option but to take the money. So here we're offered $5.4 billion in money, some of which came from Ohio taxpayers. If we turn that down in a time of need, when we have a $1.1 billion projected deficit from 2020, and of course we had an expansion in government expenditure, 369,000 new Medicaid enrollees in 2020. That's in paragraph 32 of our complaint. So we have the need, we have the ballooning of requests for benefits, and we have the fact that if we turn this down, we're telling Ohioans, not only are we not going to accept the help that you helped pay for, we're going to put all of the onus on you. And add to that the fact that our sister states will take the money no matter what. So if we don't take this money to help our businesses and our households, then the people just across the border in Michigan or Pennsylvania will get a competitive leg up. That's simply not a practical choice, as indicated by the fact that states are taking this money. I'm not aware of any that's refused to take it. That's unlike.
Was there a deadline? Do you agree there was no deadline for taking the money?
I'm not aware of a deadline, but I can't say with certainty that there was none. But we needed the money. That was the whole point of our complaint, is we did bring a coercion claim. And I understand the court may disagree with that on the merits. But to go back to Judge Bush's question on standing, we had standing at the time we filed because we did not have clear notice of what we could and could not do with our taxing authority once we inevitably and imminently accepted the funds. And then the question goes to mootness. And on mootness, they need to say that our injury has been redressed. It can't possibly come up again. That's simply not true, because now we have to work under the specter of this law that they still cannot tell us what it means. And the Ninth Circuit argument, the court was repeatedly asking for guidance on what indirectly means. And aside from giving some examples, they're not able to define those terms. And so the states don't know what they can and can't do. Ultimately, they end up falling back to the regulations. First, the regulations are not even arguably an interpretation of the law. Whatever reduction in net tax revenue means, it certainly does not mean reduction in net tax revenue relative to a 2019 inflation adjusted baseline. So it's not a construction of the statute. It's just an altogether new rule. But even if it were an interpretation, they can't cure the lack of unconstitutional clarity. As an initial matter, as every circuit to address the issue has held, Fourth and Fifth Circuits, agencies cannot, by regulation, provide the degree of clarity that the Constitution requires. They can definitely interpret statutes and implement statutes that already provide the needed clarity, but what they can't do is provide it in the first instance. And second, there's the major questions doctrine problem. My friend doesn't dispute that the meaning of the tax mandate is an issue of vast economic and political importance. And because of that, Congress has to be very clear if it means for the agency to define that term. But they didn't anywhere clearly give the agency that power. The best they can do is 802F, which says secretary may adopt such regulations as may be necessary or appropriate to carry out the section, meaning 802. The tax mandate is one part of that section, and the authority to implement the section is very different than the authority to define the meaning of a statute that bears on potentially billions of dollars in recoupment liability for the states. Finally, they appeal to the constitutional doubt canon, and they say, well, if the court, that canon, of course, says that if the statute's ambiguous, one reading is constitutional and one is not, court should prefer the constitutional reading. That canon has absolutely no application here, because once the court determines the statute's unconstitutional, is ambiguous, it's unconstitutional. There's no work for the canon to do. The ambiguity is itself the problem. So I think to tie all this together, if we look at standing and the ambiguity problem, once we say that this is ambiguous on its face, meaning Congress lacked the authority to enact it, we are harmed by it because we're forced to labor under this law, much like a vague criminal law, and we don't know how it applies to our exercise of our own sovereign authority.
All right, Mr. Powers, I'm also concerned about the remedy, the permanent injunction that the district court issued here. I think the district judge analogized to contract principles and said you need to know what the offer is before you can accept it and this and that. And if we actually do look at contract principles, if the contract is ambiguous, unenforceable, usually the contractual remedy is rescission of the contract. And here the remedy is, yes, Ohio gets the money, but guess what? They don't have to take it with the strings, that you get the money, but without the restrictions. I mean, how is that consistent with a contract analysis?
I think the key point is that if you look at cases like Sossaman, the Supreme Court said, don't take the contract analogy too far. It is just an analogy. So we still have to have remedies consistent with the Constitution. And as cases like Prince show, if the federal government, if Congress enacts a law that it lacked authority to enact, then it's unconstitutional and it can't be enforced.
Why do you keep the money then? Why do you keep the money?
Because we're not trying to strike down all of ARPA. We are still subject.
We want the money. We'll keep the money. But I don't see how you can get part of it, not all of it.
So 2 points to that. First, that's how, granted, these are more tailored challenges in other cases, but they do say that the alleged condition, like, for example, in the Haight case or Arlington, are not actually conditions on the state authority. The second key point is we are trying to strike down or permanently enjoin one narrow provision in ARPA. We are not disputing the restrictions on what we can do with the funds in 802c1, for example. So we are still subject to ARPA and the rules on what we can do with the funds. The only thing we're disputing is the enforcement of this vague provision, the definition of which no one can provide except through an agency regulation that's not even arguably an interpretation of the statute rather than a rewriting, and that would be, and that the agency lacks the authority to issue in any event.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Flowers, Judge Donald, Judge Bush?
No, even hearing that argument, it just still sounds like the state is saying that we are entitled to a possible windfall. We get to, as you said, Judge Griffin, we get to keep the money and strike down the strings, or sever it from the strings. So,
may I briefly respond, Your Honor?
Yeah. Sure.
The argument, I would understand that argument if we brought a challenge to all of ARPA and said it was inseverable and we wanted to strike down the act, then I think there would be a good argument that they can't even distribute the money and we may have to pay back whatever money we've received. But here we have not tried to enjoin all of ARPA or even close to all of ARPA. The only thing we're challenging is one particular restriction on what we do with the funds, not all of the other restrictions. Again, 802c1 says what we can do with the money. We don't challenge that. We think it's a perfectly constitutional, valid restriction on our use. So that would remain in place. So for that reason, we don't think it is a windfall. All we're seeking to do is stop them from interfering with our sovereign authority by subjecting our taxing authority to a statute that no one can define.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Winnick, 3 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of quick points. First, on ambiguity, Ohio is leaning on the criminal void for vagueness doctrine because no court has applied the Pennhurst clarity requirement in the way it's proposing, and that should tell you a great deal. At various points, Mr. Flowers called this offset provision lacking in semantic content and vacuous, and suggested that we've never suggested how to define it. That's just, none of that is true. What the statute forbids is the use of fiscal recovery funds to offset a reduction in a state's revenue, net tax revenue coming from a tax cut. The phrase directly or indirectly just clarifies, as Congress routinely uses that phrase in many other contexts, that you know, prohibition cannot be evaded by budget formalities. If a state takes the money, uses it to displace some of its own spending, and uses that savings to pay for a tax cut, that's just as much a violation as if the state takes the money and in some more direct or explicit way says, you know, we're going to use this to pay for a tax cut. And again, none of this is unfamiliar to states that have balanced budget requirements, as Ohio does and as virtually every other state does. They know that when they cut taxes, they have to be able to pay for a net reduction in their tax revenue caused by the tax cuts, either through economic growth or through spending cuts or through increases to other taxes. And all that this provision does is established that when they do that, they have to do it with their own money and can't use these federal funds to balance their books. Is it possible that questions arise down the road about how this provision applies? Sure. But as in all other ambiguity challenges, those issues can be resolved in the context of concrete disputes. It's not a basis for jurisdiction to enjoin the enforcement of the condition for all time and in all contexts against Ohio. Unless the court has further questions, we'd ask that the judgment be reversed.
Any further questions, Judge Donald? Judge
Bush? No.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will be submitted. You may call the next case.